Okay, I just have to start out and say something because a couple episodes back when we were talking about Hosea Stout, I mentioned a famous quote that Hosea Stout gave when he was in Missouri, and he said, "Brethren, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we fight." In a very typical Utah Draper mom way, I said, I would love that to be made in vinyl. And friend of the podcast and forensic genealogist and listener up in Washington, Lisa Lewis did just that. She made me a vinyl cutout of those words. So I just have to shout out to Lisa, who is hilarious, and thank her for the vinyl lettering. I'm going to turn it into a sign and craft it, and you could sell it at Quilted Bear, which is a Utah reference.
I have also had some fantastic interactions with listeners lately. Listeners teaching Utah studies, listeners wearing shirts talking about Fred the Angel with the Flaming Sword, listeners unlocking the power of AI and transcribing documents. You're all tremendous people. Even the ones of you who like baseball.
Hey now.
You know who you are.
We love it. We love that people are enjoying the podcast so much. We have fun with it. We love that you appreciate our nerdiness. Lisa Lewis, when we were talking about it, she knew all the inside jokes. It was great. It was great fun. We are a special club of nerdy people. So thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the podcast. We are having so much fun with it. We just appreciate you, and we hope to see you all coming to meet us at Sunstone Symposium this summer in Sandy, Utah. If you're out of state, please come. We have hotel deals. It's a big old party, and you're going to meet a lot of nerds like yourself, like us. Happening July 27th through the 29th in Sandy, Utah. The theme this year is mainstreaming Mormonism. And we have great, great speakers. Our keynote I'm really excited about is Kristen Cobias-Dumez, who is the author of Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation. And the book is fantastic. I would definitely recommend it. She's going to be the keynote talking about sort of Christian nationalism and this rugged masculinity culture that has infiltrated Christianity. So there's that. Brian and I will be speaking. So many good speakers this year. We're going to be talking about the anniversary of the September 6th coming up. So lots of good stuff happening. Come to Sunstone, register at sunstone.org, get your tickets now. That's the best way to support us, or leave a donation at sunstone.org. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Hold them horses, friends. First, a word from our friends at Signature Books. When Joseph Smith entered Kirtland, Ohio for the first time, he had only the year before established a church and brought forth a new book of scripture, the Book of Mormon. After moving the church and most of its members from western New York and establishing its headquarters at Kirtland, while simultaneously establishing his Zion and communities in Missouri, he oversaw a decade of both peace and prosperity and chaos and conflict. But just who was Joseph Smith, and what motivated him? In examining Smith's life during his Ohio and Missouri sojourns, Vogel seeks to answer these questions. But Vogel is quick to note, there are in fact many possible constructions of Joseph Smith, and depending on how one assesses the evidence for his truth claims, a completely different Joseph Smith emerges. But this is probably as Smith wanted it. During this period, Smith established a temple, printing presses, additional scripture, expanded church offices, and built a bank, all indicating a sense of permanence and strength for his young church at one level, while causing its near collapse at another. Charisma Under Pressure, Joseph Smith, American Prophet, 1831 to 1839 by Dan Vogel. New from Signature Books. Get it for Benchmark Books, or be a pioneer children that had to walk and walk and walk. All right, kids, here's the deal. We're going to talk about the Mormon Battalion. If you're a Gentile tuning in, you need to know that Mormons love this topic because they love their Mormon Battalion stories. Every Mormon kid grows up hearing about the courage and the fortitude of Mormon Battalion members.
That's right. We hear about their bravery, strength, and sacrifice. And that's about it. Most of us only grow up hearing that. And I knew that the Mormon Battalion were strong, brave, badass soldiers, but I couldn't really tell you why or what for or how. We just grew up venerating these guys, but I never really knew why. I knew the name Mormon Battalion, but couldn't tell you much about who they were.
Well, we're here to tell you why, the what, the who, the how. Not that you need to venerate them, but at least you'll know why Mormons are supposed to care. But, and this is important, if you're tuning in for the very first time, it's probably a good idea to back up a few episodes. The episodes are meant to go in order, so if you start at the top of the season with our Winter Quarters episodes, and then work your way down to this one, it's important. We give a lot of critical background.
Or, if you don't want to do all of that work, you can just know this. Mormon bravery, Mormon courage, fortitude, sacrifice, soldiers. There, you're all caught up. Now you know everything I knew about the battalion growing up. Hey, Brian, guess what time it is?
Hammer time!
Wrong decade. Fort time.
What?
Fort time. All right, listen, I have a thing with forts. I have warned everyone about this. Pillow forts, snow forts, blanket forts, and historical outposts that were the symptom of colonization. Forts, they are such an important part of American history. And not only are they dotted all over the United States, I also spent every summer of my adolescence working at Fort Liberty. I actually was employed by the BSA, Boy Scouts of America. Yes, as a girl, shut up out there, boys that think that that can't happen. I was a camp counselor at Cub Country every summer, and the camp was called Fort Liberty because it had an actual log fort where we had a cannon and we shot black powder rifles. And staged the Redcoats fighting the Americans. Our history was not perfect. And I did that every summer at Fort Liberty. So I am a true Mormon boy.
I remember the girls working at scout camp.
Do you really?
Oh, yes. There were girls. They worked at the little store there. And so we would go by, you know.
The trading post.
Yeah. Gum and boondoggle and whatever. And we were always, go talk to her. Go talk to her. No one ever talked to her.
So that was the thing. Girls were allowed to work at the trading post, and then by the time I come around, they had started to allow girls to take campers around. And I have to say, every time the boys group got assigned to a girl as a leader, they would be like, ugh, oh man, the little 8-year-old boys. But by the end, we had charmed their socks off, and they...
Black powder rifles will do that.
You know what? I will say this, as a girl watching 14-year-old boys have unfettered access to black powder rifles... We had more than one shooting accident. One time a kid got the casing shot through his calf. We also had BB guns up there. So there were lots of shenanigans that probably would not be allowed by regulations today. It was a great job. And I have to say the confidence was great because if you're working at scout camp, sorry, if you worked at scout camp, you know this is true. You were a nerd. And that includes the girls. But we were nerds, but we did pretty well. The odds were in our favor. with, you know, two 14-year-old girls, me and Malia, camp counselors, among a sea of nerdy 14-year-old boys. We were like Britney Spears. All right, back to business. Wherever you find white people in the Americas, you can expect to find a fort nearby. Why is that, Brian?
Well, see, if you waltz in and take over someone's land, it only seems fair that you also get to put a fort there, so then you can complain about being scared that you're going to get attacked for, checking notes here, taking over someone's land.
That's why we called it Fort Liberty. I think it, like, we venerated all the terrible American nationalism in that job. It was really, really bad. Yeah, forts are all about that. Fortresses, fortifications, outposts, whatever you want to call them. They are all over America, and they tell us, they are, like I said, they are artifacts of white encroachment, military strategy, and the expansion of the American empire. But we aren't here to talk all about forts today, but let's talk about one, Fort Kearney, shall we?
So the minute Europeans set foot on American soil, they start building forts to protect them from the people that were already living there. And as American whites and fur traders expanded further into the American West, they built more forts. The fort served as protection against indigenous resistance, against the elements, and they were also communication centers with the rest of the nation and the supply outposts. So as the Mormons expand and go west, they are venturing into Indian territory. There's not a lot of white outposts out there in the Podunk wilderness. There are some fur trading outposts that are scattered around, but it is kind of dangerous for white people unaccompanied without a fort.
And why this shows up in our story today helps explain why the government, in spite of what we will call their, rocky relationship with the Mormons, wanted to enlist Mormon help. As with many historic choices, the decisions weren't just based on one thing, and the Mormon Battalion is often cited as a response to the United States' war with Mexico. But there were other things going on too.
And this is where Fort Kearney comes into play. Careful researcher of this time would note that a lot of the battalion activity in 1846 was coming out of Fort Kearney, which wasn't officially established until 2 years later in 1848. So what's going on?
So I had to look into this because this really bothered me. When you look in journals, you see it mentioned as, you know, Fort Kearney, but the history is a little shady on when it was established. We mentioned before that Mormons weren't the only ones starting to leave the borders of the United States and head west. And we've also mentioned that for several years leading up to the Mormon exodus from Nauvoo, the lure of going to Oregon was all the rage. In fact, migration to Oregon started before Joseph Smith was even killed in Carthage. So fur traders were going there at the beginning of the 19th century, and eventually more and more people would head out west. And Oregon offered rich resources and land to anyone who could brave the trail, and people started to heed the call in the early 1840s.
I said, 1, 2, 3, pass that old bottle down. It's high west when I'm dry. 3, 4, 5, hold me sweet sugar kisses, baby, and give me heaven when I die. It's burning hot now, wild and free.
Because of this first wave of migration to Oregon, the government established an outpost in Nebraska named after Tom Osborne. Wait, sorry, that's a later Nebraska hero. In this instance, it's Colonel Stephen W. Kearney. The location of the fort is a little squishy, as well as its establishment, so, like Lindsay said, if you're going through journals at the time, you get a little confused which fort, what place we're talking about, but it doesn't really matter. You just need to know the nearest outpost of whites, which wasn't Nauvoo or Missouri, was several forts and outposts, one of which would end up being the official Fort Kearney. And it's here that the Mormon Battalion really begins.
And I had to rein it in because I did go down this whole rabbit hole of the disparity. And so they moved it around and then they rebuilt it and then they established it. So it's a whole thing. You can go down that rabbit hole too if you'd want. But basically, the fort becomes an important part of Mormon history because, again, when you hear fort from now on in this podcast, think about it as a signal that the territory that Mormons are encroaching into are so rugged that the only white outposts anywhere in the United States are really military forts or trader forts. It was wild pre-Civil War rawness, and I cannot even begin to paint a picture of the desperation and ruggedness of these areas. This was wild, wild country, and there's a new television series I'm working on for Netflix called American Primeval, which is going to take place in this time period. It's historical fiction, so settle down, historians. The timeline is going to be funny, but it deals with forts. It talks about this desperation. If you talk to the writer of this, who also was involved with who wrote The Revenant, he talks about he was really interested in the time before the Civil War. The West before the Civil War was really rugged and raw, and that's what the time period that we're entering right now.
And if there is a Greg Olson painting that is out of context in this series, I will lose it.
I promise no Greg Olson paintings this time in the series. There are, though, no, I can't say a spoiler, but there will be plenty of fun Mormon parts to tune into on Netflix, so check that out when it comes on. Rest in peace. The devil's got a hold on him, and he'll never let him free. He'll never let him free.
Okay, since you got to do your whole fort rabbit hole detour, petition to do one about the Mexican-American War real quick?
I dig it. Go.
All right, Jefferson Airplane, lead us into the rabbit hole. The territory of Mexico was established in the early 1820s, around the same time that Joseph Smith is trying to find the ghosts of old Spanish conquistadors guarding treasure. Mexico fought and won their independence from Spain in the Treaty of Cordoba in 1821.
Mexican territory was absolutely brilliant for the natural resources that were being mined at the time, and a lot of it was silver. Other minerals too, but silver mines were the wealth of the territory, and the war between the Spanish ruined the economy and set Mexico up to be poor and vulnerable to outside forces. It had a very new, somewhat 20 years old, unstable republic when the Mormons were settled in winter quarters. It was just a baby.
And meanwhile, the U.S. government is pumping out treaties, gobbling up land, including the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, and the Spanish, watching all this, are not happy that America is expanding into their controlled areas. The Louisiana Purchase set up fuzzy borders that are disputed between the Spanish and Americans. So after Mexico becomes a territory, the U.S. offered to pay Mexico outright for some of these areas that were west of the Mississippi.
And here's the thing, it's not like American democracy was exactly stable at this point either. America's still a relatively new government in its own right, but it had something that Mexico did not.
Aha. Uh-huh. Cafe Rio.
How dare you? No, it had slavery. America had built considerable wealth off of enslaved labor of Black African victims. So Andrew Jackson had financial incentives and resources to throw at the Mexican government, whose power was really fragile because of those silver mine losses that we were talking about. So eventually America would purchase what is now the West with this money, with the profits of slavery wealth. And I don't think a lot of people realize that.
And it wasn't just financial incentives that fueled this. It was a question of strategy and control. So this newborn baby Mexican government was having trouble controlling its borders, especially in the north. These areas were susceptible to attacks from Apache and Comanche and some Navajo raids. Texas obviously becomes a huge battleground in the power struggle, both literally and even figuratively. It was a fight between indigenous resistance, American, Mexican, and Spanish interests.
So long story short, America was interested in solving some of Mexico's vulnerabilities by offering them this cash that they had. So in 1842, U.S. President John Tyler was less interested in Texas than he was in acquiring the Upper California.
I swear I've heard someone sing about that.
Stop it, John Taylor, Matt Riley. And he was interested in purchasing that from Mexico to alleviate some of their debts. So Mexico was busy fighting to establish control of both California and surrounding areas, and several battles were fought as Mexico tried to shut down Spanish missions and replace old Spanish governors with Mexican loyalties. And the biggest conflicts were happening in Texas.
We've talked about the Texas part and how it kind of interweaves with Mormon interests. Remember, if you go back to our Lyman White episode, we talk about that. Texas becomes a major political dispute between Mexico and the U.S. It had just earlier declared their independence, and while the British and the U.S. would recognize Texan independence, Mexico, not interested in doing that. The U.S. tries to talk Mexico out of going to war with newly independent Texas, although they really wanted to. And a lot of the Texians there wanted to join America as a state, but that's a contentious issue in the states, and the Whigs and the abolitionists don't want to annex Texas. But no matter. Texas was annexed and joined the United States. Mexico is like, hey, what the hell?
And we'll close the rabbit hole because this could take several episodes. Basically, the annexation started a conflict between the U.S. and Mexico over sections of land and some hurt feelings. Mexico felt like the states pulled one over on them, and I suppose they kind of did. So the two new kids on the Americas block began to prepare for war with each other over these different sections of land. And here is where the Mormons enter the chat. They were supposed to go and protect California in case a war did break out. And this is reductive, of course, but there were several battles and skirmishes in Texas and other areas, but the Mormons would somehow miss all the fighting. Instead, theirs would be a war where they walked and walked and walked.
And walked? Okay, the United States of America was a hot, democratic mess in the 1840s, and several U.S. presidents wouldn't be involved in what results in the Mormon Battalion. At this point in the story, we'll go to the formation of the battalion, and the sitting American president is James Polk. And Polk knew that the Mormons wanted to emigrate to California and settle there. He needed help establishing more of a strong presence on the West Coast, and he needed that soon. But he also knew the Mormons were pissed and bitter after the big breakup in Nauvoo with the U.S. government. He knew he had to tread carefully. The government couldn't trust the Mormons, but maybe they could leverage their desperation and strike up a mutually beneficial deal. Polk recorded in his journal that the Mormons who were enlisted would, quote, constitute not more than one-fourth of Kearny's command, and the main object of taking them into service is to conciliate them.
Polk was no chump. He hoped to have the Mormons march to California on their own dime and then muster into service if the war actually started happening. Muster, of course, means to organize and be ready for war. But Polk wouldn't get his wish because the Mormons went and done got mustered up in Iowa before they made it to California. In fact, the entire battalion setup was pretty sloppy. It's said that Mormons didn't even realize they were supposed to do this on their own dime until it was too late. The government did give them money, but Brigham Young intended that that money come back to the church to fund the Great Exodus West.
General Stephen Watts Kearny would be the one to get orders from Polk to organize and lead an expedition to seize New Mexico at the outbreak of the Mexican War. Kearny got Captain James Allen to organize the Mormons and recruit them into service to form four or five companies.
Now, in 1792, it was established by the United States government that when the federal government needed to raise an army, they'd go through the governors of the state to ask permission. But since these Mormons were without a state, country, or a governor, let's be honest, Mormons hadn't had a good track record with governors as a general rule. The U.S. feds did something rare and unprecedented. They went and got permission from a religious leader to form an army.
Kearny puts a man named James Allen in charge of asking Brigham Young for this permission to draw from his camps of men to raise this army. Brigham Young agreed, of course, because this aligned with his interests. As we mentioned earlier, Brigham Young had already been petitioning the government for assistance going west, and he ended up trading the battalion for rent on federal Indian land. If you remember also, the feds thought the Mormons were initially heading west to start a rebellion, and this was a gamble on their part, but a smart one. If they could co-opt Mormon loyalty and direct it to U.S. interests, why not give it a shot? And that's what happened. Brigham was here for this trade, but the sale would be a lot more challenging to make to his flock, who didn't get the memo that the Mormons and the Americans were getting back together. They remembered when they broke up the first time. They went and talked to their friends, talked to the government's friends. Then here comes Brigham Young saying, hey guys, I know we've been through a lot these last few years. We're actually trying to leave the evil American government after they helped persecute us and kill your friends. But, you know, maybe we just let it slide this one time.
Brigham actually had to give some of the most convincing speeches of his career to date. And he does this by drawing a distinction between the evils of the acts done for and in behalf of the government of Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. He asks the Mormons to do the same. He then gives them this pitch and said, quote, suppose we were admitted into the Union as a state and the government did not call on us, we would feel ourselves neglected. Let Mormons be the first to set their feet on the soil of California. This is the first offer we have ever had from the government to benefit us. And in attendance at this gathering was Henry Bigler, who recorded that Young said, quote, "Captain Allen, you shall have your battalion if it has to be made up from our elders," and then arose from a seat, walking out, saying, "Come, brethren, let us volunteer."
And he really tells on himself here. We can see that it's early into the trek west, and Brigham is already considering a bid for statehood. And this is important, because we commonly say that Mormons hope to go west to build their own independent kingdom, and they did, but at the same time, they're also toying with the idea of statehood. And pardon me, Lindsay, but this is where Brigham Young's prophetic ways really show their muscles. He's looking ahead, he's making sure not to bite a possible hand that could offer acceptance into the Union later.
Meh. We came back away from the gifted prophet and settle for a real killer car salesman negotiator. Come on down to Big Brigham's bargains, because Brigham wasn't just getting free rent on Indian land, he was going to get some other things for this deal.
So here's the terms of the deal. First and foremost, Mormons are given express permission to settle temporarily, remember that word, on this land that's designated specifically and exclusively for Potawatomi tribes. They wanted to be able to settle on both sides of the Missouri River. Back up a few episodes if you need more info on that. The second ask was that Allen's successor would be a Mormon. They asked that Mormon Jefferson Hunt would be made captain after James Allen. Then they asked that the battalion wouldn't be split up and that the families would be able to follow with them. This was very unusual for any military regiment, and the battalion, as a result, has kids, old people, and lots of wives. This is fun. Captain Jefferson Hunt got to bring his two plural wives along with him, Matilda and Celia. All of this stuff was rare asks for standard pre-Civil War military. Sneaking in two wives, that's a real power move. It's like if you're allowed a free kids' meal from Applebee's, but then you also figure out a way to sneak in an extra quesadilla on the bill. And I just gotta say, like, hold your metaphor there, ma'am. You're trying to tell me you're at Applebee's and you're asking for extra food? That's a telestial move right there.
And I did compare women to quesadillas. I apologize. The quesadillas are wives in this metaphor. Not great.
But I mean, it's true. I don't care what anybody says, everybody has a favorite quesadilla.
I do too. It was at Morelia's, but Morelia's closed down. So thanks, Quesadilla Morelia, that is no longer around. Okay, I'm glad you mentioned pre-Civil War, because remember, we are talking about August 1846 at this point, and the Civil War would radically shift the military structure and policies in America. And this is all pre-Civil War. I told you, it's really, really rugged, and at a point where the U.S. is still figuring out how to do an army after the Revolutionary War. So they'd have a few small conflicts, battles, and wars, but it wasn't, to use a Mormon term, correlated yet, in the way that we understand the sort of 19th century army.
Let's just say the Mormons were having a hard time swallowing this pitch to leave their families. It's already hard enough. They're camped out in the middle of nowhere. There's no end to this in sight, and no agreed-upon destination. So the job is really on Brigham to convince his flock.
And again, I would argue this is really his biggest sell he has to make since convincing people into trusting his authority as a leader in Mormonism. He's already struggling with the discord in the camp strung along the Missouri, and now he has to get 500 men to agree to do this. We mentioned his pitch strategy. He was going to talk about how the Mormons have an opportunity to earn government loyalty back by doing this service. So Brigham decides to personally go through the trails of camps to Mount Pisgah, and he personally counts the wagons along the way. And historian Sherman L. Fleek, who is a pretty prolific military historian about this time, puts it this way, quote, "If one estimated that each wagon equaled at least one able-bodied military-age male, 18 to 45 years old, then some 500 men serving in the army would represent a major portion of the Saints' male population. In round numbers, perhaps as much as 30% of the young men left their families to serve in the war. This was a great sacrifice in available manpower."
And this is kind of crazy, but it's worth mentioning. The Mormon leadership had barely any notice about the battalion being organized or mustered in. It happened very quickly. And so there were plenty of folks in these Mormon outpost camps that had no idea what was going on. And they got kind of nervous when they see all these government soldiers riding up to their camps.
I think we've mentioned this before, but historian Natalie Brooks Kaufman wrote a great master's thesis on the Mormon battalion, and here's what she says happens at Mount Pisgah. Quote, "William Huntington approached Allen and asked him his business. After some scrutiny, Allen was given permission to address the camp and relate his purpose for being among the Mormons. Allen then distributed a circular to the Mormons that explained the desire of the government to form a battalion of Mormon men. Allen explained only that the U.S. military was asking for Mormon men who may be willing to serve their country in the present war with Mexico, and that they would be enlisted for 12 months. They were to make their way to California, and there they would remain until discharge.
So Mount Pisgah got the word, but meanwhile, rumors raged through the other settlements that the government was declaring war on the Mormons.
Oh yeah, Kaufman mentions in her dissertation, which we'll link, that Hosea Stout had lost a son in the attack in Nauvoo. And so the prominent scuttlebutt was that the war was brewing, and Hosea Stout, of course, was, quote, glad for the war against the government. Hosea Stout being happy to fight. Shocker. Vinyl on the wall, right, Lisa? But don't worry, the dust soon settled. Misconceptions were corrected, and men between 18 and 45 were starting to decide who should head to California to a war of a different kind.
So Brigham has got an old Pinto that he's got to sell. He starts pitching it to the different camps. First, he asked who was able to go and serve their country.
That had to be a really weird conversation, don't you think? Like, I'm surprised that he led with the patriotism argument. It just seems like the weirdest flex after the whole, you know, fling from Nauvoo bit.
Yeah, when the patriotism doesn't really work, he goes with the golden rule approach. You know, my dudes say, you know, we're going to go out west, we're going to form a state, and then what happens if there's an international crisis and the government won't support us now because we didn't have their back then? Well, that would suck.
At least we know by this point that Brigham had actually been working on a plan for the trek. His hopes were so fragmented and chaotic that it's worth noting that by July of 1846, he was seriously considering the idea that he might form a new state. Kaufman claims that this argument works, and Brigham started writing to other camps, including stragglers remaining in Nauvoo, assuring them this was a good move and that it was evidence they were making peace again with the United States government.
The Kaufman thesis is great. It's got lots of fun jewels, including the reminder that not everybody in the Mormon camp was eager to be loyal. She writes that Abraham Day adamantly proclaimed that here is one man who will not go, damn him.
Damn him. I love it. It's a great Mormon cuss. I love a stubborn Mormon man and his pride story. There's this apocryphal moment where Brigham pleads to the crowd of Mormon men about patriotic loyalty, with Captain James Allen standing by. Brigham admonishes them to be good Americans, and then the Mormon men all form this long line to enlist immediately after in perfect obedience to their spiritual leader.
Kaufman actually describes how the men had to undergo a change of heart. The best example is Daniel Rawson, who wrote in his journal, I felt indignant toward the government that had suffered me to be raided and driven from my home. I made the uncouth remark that I would see them all damned and in hell. I would not enlist. But then, Rawson is heading down to Council Bluffs. He meets Brigham and company, who tell him, quote, the salvation of Israel depended upon the raising of the army. Rawson admitted, when I heard this, my mind changed. I felt that it was my duty to go. Kaufman points out that even dudes like Hosea Stout and Abraham Day, who, quote, earlier declared their intentions to never enlist and were unabashed in their desire to watch the United States fall apart, were moved by the words of Young and what they identified as the Holy Spirit.
Also mentioned therein is the fact that a few Mormons were catching feels for the U.S. government again so hard they erected a liberty pole and raised an American flag.
Never mind. It's too easy. We're doing no more Lincoln Log jokes.
They were just getting it up, the flag that is, for the U.S. government.
So it's on July 16th, 1846, Captain James Allen stood before 500 Mormon men and made them swear their allegiance to the U.S. Captain Allen was a West Point graduate with 15 years of military experience. They were mustered in or called together in an area which is near what is now the Iowa School for the Deaf, just south of Council Bluffs. The government required that the captain and surgeon were loyal to the government to retain oversight. Young wasn't playing either, though, and he sent men he trusted, many who already had positions of leadership within the church, and certainly men he saw as most loyal, to be officers in the army.
More from historian Sherman Fleek. Quote, with the mustering of the five companies of volunteers according to Kearney's orders, Allen was now a lieutenant colonel in volunteer service. 5 days later, the battalion marched south along the Missouri River to Fort Leavenworth. After the mustering, Young, the senior apostles and ecclesiastical authority in the Latter-day Saints Church, called the Mormons, who would serve as company officers and non-commissioned officers, NCOs, in the battalion, as opposed to the tradition of volunteer soldiers electing their officers and NCOs.
Brigham told the group before they left to be fathers to their companies and manage their men by the power vested in the priesthood.
And then a, quote, merry dance was held with William Pitt's brass band playing. And for the next scene, I'll use the words of Modern Church 70 elder Lance B. Wickman, quote, then the mood grew more somber as a young woman with light hair and dark eyes and a beautiful soprano voice sang the poignant and melodic words, by the rivers of Babylon we sat down and wept. We wept when we remembered Zion. Many eyes glistened with tears. The next day was Sunday. On Monday morning, they marched away. Soldiers on an odyssey from which some would not return for a year, some for 2 or 3 years, some for almost a decade. A few would not return at all.
As the Mormon battalion departs, you can imagine what it must have been like to say goodbye to your family, knowing you might not see them again, or for at least a year anyway. As they leave, Brigham fired off a letter to President Polk. In the confidential letter, Brigham thanked the president for helping the Mormons out for once, and told him their plan was to settle in the Great Basin, not in California or Oregon. And this was something that surprised Polk. He assumed that the Mormons wanted all of that territory, might even plan on a hostile takeover of California in a rebellion. But Brigham was smart. Knowing now, if California is disputed between the two countries, he doesn't want to get in the middle of that, so he offers to settle this no man's land.
Well, indigenous land.
Interesting, right? That term gets used a lot to describe the area. Well, since no one really wanted it, they would just go settle there. All the youths are kind of holding their hands up being like, we want it. That's why we're
Shoshones,
living here.
Paiutes.
That's why we've been living
me.
Here for a long time, you know. Yeah. So, they says, okay, we'll settle this land in between California and the United States. And it's a clever move. It's one that shows that even the Mormons initially hoped to leave the United States, at this point they realize that they can't really get out. Being part of the states is an inevitability.
But Brigham also didn't want President Polk to think that Mormons had pulled a fast one by bowing out of California. They had enlisted with the intention to go to California, not to form their own territory. And so the letter is saucy because Brigham Young tells Polk about a trauma rumor he heard. He heard that former Missouri Governor Buhus Boggs was going to be appointed the governor of California. He claimed that if this happened, their hands were stained by blood and the Mormons could never stay in California. Take that, Sam Brannan.
Yeah, take that, Sam Brannan, you filthy smash brother.
So California was out, but it's interesting, and Kaufman points this out in her dissertation, that Brigham telling his intentions early on is fascinating because he goes to Utah and ends up trying to establish an independent territory anyway, called Deseret. We'll, you know, of course, get more into this a lot later, but it is a curious move. When the battalion left, Brigham did tell the Mormon battalion folks that he hoped to settle in the Great Basin, which must have been another interesting moment for everyone, because remember, up until this point, everyone, including Brigham Young, isn't still quite sure where they're headed. So the Mormon battalion formation was able to give Young and other leaders insight into American interests and plans, kind of put a fire under them to make plans of their own, which gives them the final nudge to decide their own plans.
I said, one, two, three, pass that old bottle down. Now, friends, it's time to play Apocryphal Battalion Storytime. There are a few things more perfectly Mormon than faith-affirming lore, and the battalion records? Full of it.
Something else Natalie Kaufman's thesis gives us besides great details of the battalion are great faith-building stories, and here's one.
So, we have a man, he's not Mormon, they're camping out with a group in winter quarters. He's young, his family had followed the Mormons to Council Bluffs in the hopes of going west to California. This guy had befriended his Mormon neighbors, and he'd followed their plight, so when he hears that the government was there to enlist Mormons, he is super pissed and offended at the nerve on behalf of his Mormon friends.
And this is where it gets miraculous, though, because soon, I guess this Gentile felt a need to keep up with the Kardashians because he watched the Mormons forgive and forget their beef with the USA and turn around and enlist. He was so touched by the Mormons' newfound patriotism, he enlisted, and then he immediately got baptized, saying, "Wonders never cease."
And then probably asked, "And when can I get in on the polygamy business?"
Gross.
Okay, I'll give you one thesis faith-affirming story and raise you a miraculous healing. Another enlister named Alonzo Raymond wanted to join the battalion, but he had some incurable ailment. It said that Heber Kimball rode by on his horse, saw the dejected Raymond. When he heard the story, he prophesied if Raymond would enlist, he would be healed.
Oh my gosh, a Heber healing is what makes this a true Mormon story. Did he get out like a special handkerchief or like a stick to do it? Did it involve a dream with a river, perhaps?
Maybe a magic saddle? Not to be confused with a blazing saddle. Who knows? Any case, according to Kaufman, within a few days of enlisting, Raymond was perfectly healthy and ended up walking all those miles with his soldier buddies.
Hallelujah.
Kaufman also mentions that Daniel Tyler recounts that before the battalion heads out of camp, they are promised by Brigham Young that if they remain righteous, no bullets will hit them.
Oh my gosh. Okay, not this. This is the 19th century version of Brother Marriott Hotel who wore his garments and wasn't burned in some bougie yacht fire because he was righteous.
I feel like you are not expressing the right level of reverence, but I digress. Young also tells all the Mormon dudes to rely on faith healings rather than the medical doctors. He told them, refuse the army's help with medicine. This gives off a lot of Warren Jeffs vibes.
Buchanan's Law, you brought it up, not me. I'm not happy about the story because different iterations record Young as promising their safety, their security, and the absence of bloodshed, and it's generally accepted as true, but guess what? It's not. I'm going to mention an account in a minute where it's very clear that bloodshed did happen, but first, more spiritual experiences. I'm going to bring us a good persecution narrative. I quoted LDS 70 Elder Wickman's tribute to the battalion. His entire talk is a tribute to the persecution narrative as well. I'd like to paint a portrait for our non-Mormon listeners out there of what a solid Mormon persecution story told over the pulpit to us from birth sounds like. Brian, give it to us in your best Mormon GA voice. Tell us how Elder Wickman describes the hardships of the battalion.
Cue the teleprompter. But most of all, it was the physical hardships that were so difficult to bear. Searing sun, thirst, cold winds, hunger, thirst, sand, always more sand, thirst, rock, thirst. 6 months into their trek, most of the men had traded away any spare clothing in exchange for food. Rags and pieces of hide took the place of shoes. Hair and beards were unshaven and uncombed. Skin was darkened to a deep leathery brown. Bones and ribs of man and beast protruded through stretched flesh. The 339 survivors, who at last struggled into San Diego that lovely midwinter day in January 1847, each bore a wild but strangely holy countenance. They had made it. They had come through for their country and for Zion. On the morning after their arrival, Colonel Cook wrote, "The Lieutenant Colonel commanding congratulates the battalion on their safe arrival on the shore of the Pacific Ocean and the conclusion of their march of over 2,000 miles. History may be searched in vain for an equal march of infantry."
Yes, it's our ancestral poetry and prose, those persecution narratives.
There's another great contemporary journal account to mine the misery from, where the battalion soldiers who are walking across the plains are so famished. They come upon a pond of buffalo pee and green film. They are so thirsty that they drink it, and surprisingly, all of them get sick.
Scenes we didn't get in Legacy but should have. And what about the fact that they made it an 102-day voyage on 60 days of rations? Many battalion members will talk about this miracle, although contemporary reports have it being more of a story of how bad things sucked. And later, when they talk about the anniversaries and reminiscences, it will be a loaves and fishes miracle. But it basically just meant that they ran out of food.
Even though they were so thirsty sometimes, they had to drink bull urine? That'd be a good t-shirt to bring home. "I drank so much buffalo piss, and all I got was this raging dysentery." All right, how about this one? Reddick Allred, who was a quartermaster, hurt his hand in an accident regarding corralling animals. Then he has a dream that he would be healed, and then he was healed. His journal actually has several miraculous dreams, including one of Joseph Smith saving him at an execution with a knife. Very dramatic.
You know what? Reddick Allred's dreams were fun, and we will link his account in the show notes. I like that many Mormons dream to Joseph Smith, and Reddick gives us a good account. And one thing I do want to say is I was, you know, after reading, I read so many journals, battalion journals, and it really did became like an oppression Olympics, you know, like their stories of survival and suffering. And I was telling this to a historian friend who's not a Mormon, but understands American history. And that historian was like, you understand that everybody on the frontier had this. Have you heard of the Civil War? Like everybody suffered. I think that's a funny reminder.
I remember there's one where they're sort of like the Buffalo P one. They're at a watering hole and it has wigglers and they use like their handkerchiefs to strain them out so they can get a drink. Lots of stories like this. Yeah. Welcome to the West.
It sucked for everybody.
It's not called the Calm West, as I recall. So there's also the interesting idea coming from this time period that the no face card rule for Mormons comes from the battalion.
So it's entirely possible that you, as a Mormon kid, weren't allowed to gamble M&Ms in the family poker game after dinner because Mormons didn't want to get corrupted by the U.S. soldiers. So maybe blame our face card ban on the U.S. government because it helped the culture of face cards being naughty in Mormonism.
It's said, we've got several accountings of this from various sources, that Brigham Young, before he sends the soldiers off, tells them to be nice and obedient and to burn any face cards. Because there should be no fun on the trail. Rather, he wanted them to appear to be virtuous under the soldiers' watchful eyes. He told them not to swear, to read their scriptures, and if they did all this, like I said, they would be spared shedding blood. And they must not have all played face cards because this turned out to be true. So here's my thought. What if it's as simple as Brigham was just bad at poker? I could totally see him as a guy with no poker face. A guy who yells, "Shit on Congress!" every time he gets three of a kind.
See, it's the swearing and the face cards. Two strikes out. Remember, kids, face cards are the slippery slope to bloodshed. But someone must have been playing with face cards, because actually, you're wrong about the no bloodshed thing, and so are most historians. We talk about all these peaceful Mormons not doing any killing, but if you read the journals of battalion members closely, they tell a murkier story. There were times that battalion members murdered Indigenous people, but I guess that doesn't count. Consider this account from Nathaniel Jones's journal. He was a faithful Mormon battalion member, and he's, of course, going back with Kearney. We'll talk about why he's there. On May 8th of 1847, he's still enlisted, and here's what he says, quote, May 8th. Today, news came that General Kearney had arrived at San Pedro. This morning, there was a detachment of 20 ordered to take out some Indians in the mountains. I was detailed as one of the number. We left camp at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, traveled until late in the night when we came to a ranch. We cooked our suppers, then started in an easterly direction and traveled until morning, cooked our breakfast 5 miles from camp, and then we started for the mountains in a northeasterly course. At the mouth of the canyon, we separated. 8 of us went up to the mountains to cut off their escape in that way. We attacked them in the head of the canyon. We killed 6 of them. How many there were in the first place, I do not know, but there were some escaped certain. We then returned to camp just before night. There were 2 men wounded, one in the face and one in the thigh, though not dangerous. There was 1 Spaniard wounded in the leg. The Spaniards used the Indians very brutally. Scalped them and cut off their ears and nose before we knew what they were about or we could have prevented them.
And this is an important point. In battalion accounts, this is not an isolated incident. There are several instances where battalion members were ordered to kill various Indian tribes, and for whatever reason, probably racism and imperialism, this wasn't seen as shedding blood in the same way as even killing Mexican soldiers would have been.
It might get a little confusing because the battalion group that initially leaves winter quarters ends up splitting up about 3 times. As they start heading out, it becomes pretty apparent that sending 500 men with their wives and gaggles of kiddos and elderly was a terrible idea. This spread sickness throughout the camp, and the elderly and young that were there really slowed things down. So there are several breakoffs, and I'm going to give you the main names, but these detachments actually have various names throughout different journals. So the first breakoff is known as the First Detachment, and most commonly known as the Higgins Family or the Arkansas River Group, and it corresponds corresponds with the first Lieutenant A.J. Smith, acting lieutenant commander of the battalion, who was in a hurry to catch up with Kearney and his men. But the women and children slowed it down, so Smith assigned Company D and 10 soldiers under the command of Captain Nelson Higgins to take 44 dependents of women and children to Fort Pueblo. After the soldiers dropped the families off to winter there, the soldiers were to return to the battalion in Santa Fe.
The second group left in October for similar reasons. It's known as the Santa Fe Detachment. It's made up of 121 people, 91 soldiers, 27 of whom were very sick, 19 women, 10 children, and a Mormon doctor named William McIntyre. They also went to Fort Pueblo to convalesce. 5 wives and 1 child were given permission to remain with the battalion and then head to San Diego.
And the last group is most commonly known as the Willis Detachment, and here's what the California Pioneer Foundation says about them, quote, 3 weeks and 279 miles out of Santa Fe down the Rio Grande Valley, the battalion reached the location where General Kearney had abandoned his wagons and turned west toward the Gila River Valley. Colonel Cook evaluated the condition of the battalion and determined that there were 56 men who were declared physically unfit to continue. Furthermore, the mules were nearly broken down and his ration supplies were insufficient. Colonel Cook ordered Lieutenant William Willis, Company A, to organize a detachment of the sick and least effective men, draw 26 days' rations consisting of 800 pounds of flour and pork, 1 large wagon, and 1 team, and report back to Santa Fe for instructions.
Here's what church historian B.H. Roberts says about the 300-mile journey. After much suffering from the hardships of the journey, weak teams, scant supplies of food, illy clad, general sickness among the men, the fall of December snows in the mountain ranges north of Santa Fe, excessive cold, and several deaths occurring, this detachment finally arrived at Pueblo between the 20th and 24th of December in a most pitiable condition. But they were warmly received by members of the battalion already quartered there, numbering now, all told, about 150.
All battalion members were issued $42 for a clothing budget, and while that sounds like a lot of money for 1846, most of it was sent back to families and the church to finance the trek. That was about $1,500 a person in today's dollars. Multiplied by 150 dudes, that comes out to almost $250,000, and that's a massive shot in the financial arm, and most of it went back to Church HQ in winter quarters.
And for all you gun nerds out there, the men were issued a Springfield Model 1816 69 caliber flintlock musket. These guns were the upgrade after the War of 1812, showed the Americans that their weapons kind of sucked. The gun was 58 inches long and had one of those new fancy-schmancy percussion cap inventions.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. These 1816 models would be used in the American-Mexican War all the way up to the Civil War. And prior to these guns, rifles like those in the Revolutionary War or that we used at Fort Liberty had used flint-striking steel frizzen to ignite powder to fire the gun. And this meant a lot of misfires, especially in bad weather if it was rainy. The invention of the percussion cap meant that there was a little weather-protected mechanism in the gun that after you pulled the trigger and it sort of like acted like an anvil that would smash this mercury fulminate inside and detonate it, which would cause a spark. So it's small, but it's a super cool invention for the time that really revolutionized guns and got a lot of people killed.
Their guns might have been fine, but they had no uniforms since none of the armies heading west at this time were issued uniforms. So they were dressed however they wanted. Rumors are there were a lot of crop tops. Not sure if that's been verified yet. That's what I've heard. Their ragtag appearance reflected their makeup. They're a scraggly lot. They're made up of people too old and too young to be fit for service. They walked or marched everywhere they went, and that meant waiting for the slowpokes. As a result, they didn't make great time, and by late August, their leader, James Allen, died of an illness and was quickly replaced by a British-born Army First Lieutenant, Andrew Jackson Smith, who took over. Let's just say the Mormons didn't dig this guy in spite of a surname. He's a store brand Smith.
Also, I read several battalion journals to research this, and in one account, Nathaniel V. Jones's diary, he mentions that Lieutenant Smith had, quote, a Negro servant, and that, quote, belonged to him. So we know that an enslaved person, at least one, was also part of the battalion.
That's important, too, because often we don't realize that not only was the West purchased with slavery profits, but enslaved people were a part of the pioneering West. Some by force, some by choice, but their histories are often erased. And they traveled those really grueling marches in these conditions right along with the white folks whose names we have better records of.
It was a rough gig, and as they marched very slowly to Santa Fe, they were met by an experienced frontier officer named Lieutenant Colonel Philip St. George Cook. And Cook would surprise the tired group with a new mission. He was to take some of the regiment and a bunch of really heavy freight wagons on to California. 86 dudes and all the kids and most of the women left shortly after to Fort Pueblo, which is in Colorado.
Do we know how many children were part of the battalion?
So the records are a little bit contradictory for the headcount. We have an estimate, and we think about a dozen young boys also came that served as aides to officers, and then a handful of kiddos.
So is this like the kid version of "My grandpa was a bodyguard to Joseph Smith"?
Absolutely. Cook was, I think everyone thinks they have a battalion ancestor. Cook was less than impressed with the kids and families and complained about them often. Imagine that. I don't know who thought sending children to war was a great idea, but you have to admit it's a very Mormon thing to drag all your kids in the minivan to go to war. When the group arrived in Santa Fe, they were greeted with a fancy gun salute from the commander named General Alexander Doniphan. And here's where, if we haven't mentioned it yet, you should know that when the federal government was getting recruits for Dragoons from the Mormons, they also pulled a few ragtag groups of men mustered in, get ready to clutch your pearls, Mormons, men from Missouri.
And this matters because it shows some interesting old wounds from the Mormon and Missouri conflict. Natalie Kaufman reminds us that Doniphan, of course, is the dude in Missouri who prevents Joseph Smith from being executed at Far West during the Missouri Mormon War. With that background, she points out that, quote, "The salute to the Mormon battalion in Santa Fe apparently enraged Colonel Sterling Price, a Missourian who had arrived 3 days prior with his command, but without the pomp and circumstance that was accorded the Mormons." Daniel Tyler surmised Doniphan's special welcome was due to Doniphan's memory of the wrong which they, the Mormons, had suffered from the Missouri mobocrats, which prevented him from extending any courtesies to Colonel Price and his disgraceful command on their arrival.
This wasn't the only issue. Mormons resented their federally appointed leaders, specifically Lieutenant Andrew Jackson Smith and the Army surgeons, George P. Sanderson. And apparently, this is important because he was a crappy doctor and prescribed calomel for everything. And, you know, this was a pretty standard 19th century practice. Doctors didn't understand the compound, but knew that it treated constipation by acting like a stimulant or, sometimes fun, a sedative. So apparently the camp surgeon was very aggressive in his prescription of it, and Mormons were convinced he was trying to poison them. They actually nickname him Dr. Death. And I have to say, this isn't completely unfounded because calomel is basically mercury powder. It is poison. So he was poisoning them.
So when Captain Cook and Kearney took over for Smith, the Mormons are jazzed. They're still getting mercury poisoning, however. You can't win them all. Throw mercury poisoning into the persecution stories pile.
I feel like that one's fair. We'll allow it.
Well, and remember, Joseph Smith's brother Alvin apparently had been killed by an earlier generation crappy doctor giving him calomel. It's in the history there.
So in October of 1846, the rest of the group that hadn't initially headed out to Santa Fe left to head to California. This group had 400 men, 4 women, and several scouts.
They followed the Rio Grande south, and here is where the closest thing to fighting was for the Mormons. Sorry, Hosea Stout. The Mormons were trying to cross a hamlet on their trail. It's basically present-day Tucson. That was defended by 60 to 100 more Mexican soldiers. What's funny is this so-called battle has a name, the Capture of Tucson. It even has its own Wikipedia page. Now remember, the Mormons marched like they were soldiers and called themselves soldiers.
But they weren't dressed as soldiers because their crop tops gave them away.
But they felt like soldiers, and they liked to march, but they'd never actually trained as soldiers. It didn't matter because Lieutenant Cook had his regiment of Mormon men form a skirmish line, and that scared off the Mexican soldiers who retreated, and the Mormons were allowed to cross the hamlet.
Oh, thank goodness.
Such bravery. When we say the men marched to California, it's not like a pleasure stroll. They had to break the trail for the wagons. That's using axes and picks, no machines. Twice, they had to break rocks and canyons to get through. They drank so much buffalo pee, they broke their wagons, their backs, and their own hearts.
In the faithful LDS accounts like Elder Wickman's, he likes to talk about how Brigham Young's prophecy came true that no man would lose his life in battle and how that was true. But even he had to admit that 22 of the 400 men died because of the grueling march and exposure and were buried along the trail.
That's sad. But is it as sad as the bull stampede story? Because that's the story you usually hear as a kid. In Reddick Allred's account, he talks about how they encountered a large herd of wild cattle, the bulls charged, and a battle resulted that ended in the wounding of two men, some mules killed, and a bunch of cattle dead. The Great Bullfight was the only battle the Mormons fought, except that it wasn't.
Except that it wasn't.
And they jokingly called this the Battle of the Bulls.
Ha ha ha. Don't forget the countless accounts, and I mean countless accounts, of buffalo chips.
Ah, the buffalo chips. If you didn't collect dried buffalo dung on the prairie to burn as tinder, bro, are you even a Mormon pioneer? Buffalo stories are full of buffalo chip accounts.
Indeed, but 1847 was anything if not the year for Mormons. In January of 1847, the battalion was able to see the Pacific Ocean in the distance for the first time, and 2 days later, they arrived at their destination in San Diego.
Here's Nathaniel Jones' account of what it looked like when they arrived. The mission of the San Diego is beautifully situated on a gentle elevation of tableland, which is about 3/4 of a mile in length and 1/2 mile in width, and about half as high as the general bluffs along the streams. The building is about 14 rods in front and is a little over 1 story high. The walls are of unburnt brick and whitewashed outside and in. The building is covered with concave tile, which are laid on and lashed fast. The burying ground is on the east side, the church on the west. The church is nearly 2 stories high. The front has a rude representation of a steeple. This building is constructed upon the same principle as the buildings of New Mexico, having a square in the center. The square here was nearly the west end in the rear of the church. The rooms are dark and damp with brick floors. There are 2 beautiful vineyards on the flat in front of the building. They are interspersed with olive trees in the front, and in the front of the vineyard on the left are 2 beautiful palm trees with a large wine press in the front corner.
And thankfully, by January 1847, the war between Mexico and the U.S. was winding down, and the fighting, although it would take about a year to fizzle out, the Mormons skirted the skirmishes, if you will, and were just chilling in SoCal.
But the story doesn't end here. No. The aftermath of the conflicts and skirmishes broke something inside the U.S. Army. A big fight was brewing inside the military leaders between Kearney and John C. Fremont. Military historian Sherman Fleek describes how Kearney teamed up with a Navy Commodore named Robert Stockton and vanquished the last Californio army in 2 battles near present-day Los Angeles in early January 1847. After this, Stockton got those middle fingers up, he put them hands high, he waved it in Kearney's face, and told him, boy, bye. Fleek explained that he, quote, refused to recognize Kearney's superior rank and orders from President Polk to form a government and serve as governor. With no authority to do so, Stockton appointed Lieutenant Colonel John C. Fremont, the famous Pathfinder, as military governor. Kearney attempted to push his position, but with only some 50 dragoons loyal to his orders, he had to wait until other reinforcements arrived, and those first reinforcements were the Mormon battalion. Kearney then took immediate action and departed by ship to Monterey to assume the governorship. Fremont, once back in the United States, was arrested, tried, and found guilty of mutiny and disobedience.
This was some drama. It's known as Fremont's Rebellion, and when you read journals and reminiscences, this was a big deal. Reddick Allred acknowledges that Fremont trying to be governor without permission was bad, but really he was arrested because he was a bitter enemy to the Mormons in the Missouri expulsion, and Kearney walked him back to Washington with a guard of Mormon men, much to Fremont's annoyance.
His account's cool. He talks about another guy named John Allen, who deserted his post as picket guard and was court-martialed. The regular officers voted to shoot him, but the volunteers convinced him to be condemned to having half of his head shaved and then kicked out of camp. Then the Mormons pull out their brass band, make Allen walk from left to right while they played the Rogue's March, and he was kicked out of camp.
I love how Mormons really pioneered the shame punishments. That feels right.
Honestly, he might have preferred the regular officer's plan over the Rogue's March walk.
Half the head shaved. Such an interesting choice.
Weird. Who knows?
Fleek points out that while all this was going on, the Mormons were still on the hook for service. So a detachment escorts Kearney to take Fremont back to D.C. and the rest stay in California. And that's where, you know, that story I told about the Mormons killing, you know, a group of indigenous people happens. The group that escorts Fremont have quite an adventure, and they even stumble upon the fated Donner Party's cannibal camp, which we will go into more detail in an upcoming episode.
The rest that stayed back trained in what's present-day L.A., and finally learned some actual soldier drills, a practice I'm sure the U.S. government would regret just a decade later. But finally, as promised, a year to their enlistment on July 16, 1847, the Mormons were released from their duty. About 80 of them re-upped for 6 months to protect California. A handful of them joined as military assistants, but the rest nestled down either in San Bernardino or eventually headed to Utah to join their families, where Brigham's company would shortly arrive from the east.
And when the remaining crew reunited with their families or into the valley with Brigham Young, it was in the winter of 1847. There was a small jubilee planned, and Brigham Young is reported to have said to Heber Kimball, "These men were the salvation of this church, or at least their $225,000.
According to Kaufman, on April 18, 1847, a sailor named Beckworth got baptized and became the first convert in the West, and then, only 2 days after they arrived, one of the four women that had walked the entire march gave birth to a son who is said to be the first child of American parents born in California. There you have it, friends. The stories of the good old battalion boys of Mormonism.
Don't worry, though. In our next episode, we're going to tell you about all those ladies of the battalion.
Mother, don't cry for me. I've done chose the life I lead. Yes, you told
me. I never loved nobody fully, always one foot on the ground. And by protecting my heart truly, I got lost in the Books of Mormon's report, powered by Benchmark Books. So we've got two good overview books on the Mormon Battalion. The first and earliest is Norma Baldwin Rickett's Mormon Battalion, U.S. Army of the West, 1846-1848. It's probably the best single volume for the overall history of the battalion. The second book is Sherman Fleek's History May Be Searched in Vain, A Military History of the Mormon Battalion. As you can guess from that title, it's a little more focused on the military nature of the battalion, not that he doesn't get into some of that larger context, though. Finally, something we've mentioned before, Natalie Brooke Kaufman's thesis, The Mormon Battalion's Manifest Destiny, Expansion and Identity During the Mexican-American War. This does an excellent job on the larger national context of what's going on at this time.
Smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.